Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. This week, we're welcoming back two of my dearest friends. Blake Howard is a film writer and the prolific podcaster behind One Heat Minute Productions. He and I had so much fun producing the show Midnight Run Through, which you can catch wherever you get your podcasts, either in my feed for Watch with Jen or his at One Heat Minute Productions. Blake also created a really amazing website for the podcast series with pictures and more information. So you should be sure to check that out. And joining Blake and me today, we have my good buddy, Rob Belushi. Rob wears so many hats. I'm always incredibly impressed with what he has going on because it's always exciting. He is an actor, producer, Second City alum, game show host, multi-hyphenate, one of the most hilarious and talented and also just genuinely nice guys that you can hope to come across. So this is quite the pair of kind, funny, insightful guys, and I'm so pleased that they're joining me today. So without further ado, let's get into it. Guys, thank you so much for being here. How are you doing?
We're good. I'll speak for Blake and say that he's always good.
Yeah.
I'm just back from my little getaway, Jen, spot. And I remember when I saw Rob last, we were talking about it, my little holiday spot that I frequent. And he's like, oh, no wonder you're so fucking happy. So I'm feeling great. I come back to talk to you guys who I love about a show that I love. This is good. I'm happy.
Very good.
You really do. It's like if Bill Tench's life turned out as planned and not devolved into a nightmare, it's you.
Nancy Tench. We're going to have to talk about it. Yeah. So Jen, you invited us here to talk about this show largely because Rob and I bullied our way onto your series. Cause we're like, we love this series and we want to talk about it somewhere, but this is a Jen kind of experiment was our offering. Come take us, let us talk about a show. You know, we so rarely get to talk about TV, nor is TV so often unworthy, in my opinion, to talk about or to waste your time on. I remember someone saying to me, like, have you seen that show, The Flash? I'm like, how many episodes is it? They're like, oh, it's like 22 episodes a season at 50 minutes. And I'm like, I'm going to stop you there. I'm not investing that much time in my life for that. No way.
Yeah.
Not a chance, Lance.
Not a chance. But Mindhunter, that's a good investment. That's a decent investment in your time, with all the talent that is associated with it.
It is. And I loved covering Mr. In Between with you both in the past.
Another worthy show.
I've only done a handful of TV shows on Watch with Jen, but I liked this idea. It was kind of Rob's brainstorm. You guys know you're always welcome on. I always worry I'm nagging you too much, like, come back on and talk to me. So I have to kind of watch like how much I bother you, but I love that you guys wanted to do this. I am not a big serial killer, true crime buff person at all. And so I kind of joked that I was going to need to, if I was having nightmares, I was going to put them on speed dial and call them at 3 a.m. or watch it in the morning only. And I basically did watch the show in the morning. Okay. As it kind of got more and more addictive, but I stopped at like 5 o'clock. It was like, you know what? That's my cutoff. That's when your caffeine cutoff should be. And that's when you're, yes. When I had to,
I do. I have my last coffee at 4:30. So
there you
go. Cut off. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was kind of the Mindhunter caffeine cutoff. But thank you for, inspiring me. This is an outstanding series.
So glad to look. Happy to be back. Thanks for going somewhere dangerous for you. It's fun to talk about this series. But being here with Blake is an honor, and you, obviously, Blake is your guest. It's an honor to sit amongst your incredible guests, both of you, because I'm just a.
I feel that
you're
way
a co-host
about
of one of our shows. You don't have to be honored anymore that yeah. we talk. I love you. Stop
Hello.
It.
Hello. You're like family. Both of you guys are like
you're part of the furniture of your 1-8 minute production.
Yes. When my mom is ready to adopt Rob, basically.
Your mom
loves him at breakfast. Yes.
Rob Belushi and Blake Howard, big with moms.
Yeah.
Big
oh
with
my God.
Moms.
My mom loves Blake.
Local and
yes.
abroad. Local and abroad.
I mean, if you tell me at the beginning of breakfast it's your treat, it's like Luis Guzman in Monte Cristo. I am your man for life. You know?
You were such a sweetheart. Rob was like going inside the restaurant and chasing down the one page of menu that was missing for Priscilla. It's amazing. Yeah.
Well, hey, you look, you know, just, I love your mom. I was so happy to meet her. Like, what a wonderful person. I think she'd get along very well with my mom.
Yeah.
Blake won't let me meet his mom. Strangely. It's weird.
I know. We got to get on a plane and go down to Australia.
We don't need to go down this road. It's much more like the Tench family dynamic. Let's just move on. You just want to go back to the house and it be empty. That's what we want. So we're just moving straight past that.
I love that you bring up the Tench family dynamic.
Yeah.
I just briefly like this fits stuff that Blake and I have been talking about recently because we've been on a bit of a John Douglas kick. So we did Silence of the Lambs, and then he's doing his incredibly ambitious and hugely informative Manhunter, about Manhunter, right? Which is Thomas Harris as well, but he bases Jack Crawford on this guy, John Douglas, who Mindhunter is essentially his story. He's Holden, and I believe, right, Blake?
Yeah, exactly. You're spot on. And the book Mindhunter is written by John Douglas.
And it's a great book.
It's a great book. After I read this series, Rob and I were geeking out about reading the book because the book is a fascinating artifact. You can tell why anyone who has read it, you've had all these morsels of like cinematic influence, like why it's so fascinating, because it's still fascinating to this day. So yeah, it's a brilliant, brilliant read and a real like page turner. It's great.
And on top of that, the first book I read by John Douglas was his book about BTK, which is so funny because, you know, it's what would be the spine of Mindhunter.
Yeah.
And the interviews that he has in the book, you know, are verbatim to Mindhunter. So it's just a fascinating, like the way they wrap narrative around like semi-fictional characters, but were data first in the conversations with their subjects, I thought was such a great and interesting and like thematically, supportive element. Just like these are the conversations they have, and obviously those, like, the most boring thing in the world are interviews, unless it's John Douglas interviewing sadists, narcissists, and, you know, absolute depraved individuals. And so this darkness thing, I hope this might be the end of our kind of, I mean, Blake will live in the darkness forever, and I am clawing my way out. But, you know, this is a nice, like, end to what we've been discussing lately, which is thematically the masks we wear in life.
Yeah.
And then how those masks as a social construct and a survival dynamic are subverted by predators, outliers to the social system, or those who believe in the social motivational journey, how they're subverted and those masks end up killing us, you know?
Yeah.
And so Kemper is like, I mean, I love him. I mean, I hate him. Obviously I would never like him, but like he's, I love him as a character in the show. And it's such a great jumping off point because he's not a picture of, he's a fresh picture even now, but especially in the 60s or 70s, whenever this is, it's all the same to me if it's pre-80s. you know what?
It's right on the cusp of the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Is it right late on the 70s? Cusp.
Yeah, it's late 70s because, and I had to orient myself last night again. I wanted to watch the bridge between episode season one and season two.
Yeah.
Because I love that, the chaos of the end of season one and the kind of like reorientation at the beginning of season two. And they're saying like his last kill, that they were talking about BTK, and they're like his last one was in 77 and this new one's popped up. And it's all this chaotic stuff and it's just new details. And it's the first time we hear the words. I think it might be one of the first times you hear it in the whole series, BTK.
Yep.
We've been watching him. We've been seeing this guy who is the ADT serviceman doing different things, but we haven't, we don't actually see it. Cameron Britton, Jen, Cameron Britton as Ed Kemper is so magnificent in this series that it's completely addictive to me. And when you actually, and if you are a Mindhunter freak, you go down the rabbit holes of going and watching the real videos of Edmund Kemper, him talking and hearing his voice, and you hear Cameron Britton like basically embodies this creepy, detached, slow-moving voice. And you're like, oh, this is one of the most magnificent performances on TV. And it's such an anchor of the show. And
butchering people is hard work.
Yeah, he said he kept redoing his audition on tape because he said when he started watching all of these YouTube videos, said there's something about the eyes, like the eyes needed to be scarier, and like I can do more. And I found one of the most interesting things when he was talking about what he called upon to play that part was he had been a preschool teacher, special needs preschool, and working with, you know, autistic and kids that were, you know, lovely one
God,
day.
What a hero. Those teachers.
And then the next day were terrors. My mom did that for like a year and kind of like hurt her back. And it was a lot. And just how exhausting it is and how emotionally draining. And he said the only way he could get through it, he said, what I had to do was shut off my emotions and just be pleasant and, you know, be authoritative and do my job, because it was like 3-hour class. And then he said, and then after they left, then I would go into a bathroom and just like everything would come out and I'd start crying. Like he could only do it, I think he said, for about 18 months and it became too much. But he said,
you need to vent.
Yes. He said, you know, like if he broke, kind of like an actor thing, during those 3 hours, then they won, you know, then he lost control of the class and it was chaos. And so he said, when I was playing Kemper, I was finding myself going back to that idea of turning off your emotion just for a little bit and being very matter of fact and very personable, talking to these guys.
I thought you'd appreciate the dramatic gesture.
Yeah. I know, I love that, and how they just kind of luck into talking to like a chatty Kathy, like they're recommending, oh, you can't talk to Manson, but you could talk to this guy. And because they had somebody that like ready to talk to, they all love talking to law enforcement, but because they had somebody that like stoked, that kind of led them onto this. And I thought that was interesting as somebody who hasn't read the John Douglas books or doesn't know as much as you guys. I did like that. Yeah.
Is that what we are, holding friends?
Friends.
We get some Ron Belushi impressions. I love it.
It's like that. Like I'm in there and like Holden's like, in terms of work or whatever, but you know, I'm like, yeah, we're friends. Are you kidding? We're hanging out. We spend time together. You tell me secrets. I tell you, like, this is a friendship.
Yeah, we had pizza.
You sent me adorable little cards. Bless your heart.
Yeah.
I just want to talk. So
That's really interesting about that actor, because he is exceptional. And they all are.
Oh my God, they all are. Yep.
Every single person in the show
is a fucking grand slam. And I say that like the most excited, and this is a silly story from an actor, but like I got to audition for Manson. And it was like the most, I still have the tape. Like it was on my birthday too. And I was in New York when it happened. So like I shot it in some like
basement.
How have
we not seen this, Rob?
Well, I mean, when I did it on Mindhunter, they used a lot of prosthetics. No, I'm kidding. I didn't get the part obviously, but it was such a great feeling.
Yeah.
To first of all, look enough like Manson to get that that job. But and also, you know, what I did with it was very similar to what the guy ended up doing. I mean, he was fucking amazing, obviously, and so scary and weird. But the notes from the director on the audition, and it was just like, it's not an impression. You're the guy, you know, make it real and watch tape, you know, and that's what I did. And I did the best I could. And it was, you know, didn't get the part.
You lost out to a guy, to be fair to you as an actor, who just played Manson in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, a cutout almost. It's not the same guy, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Aussie. Rob, you don't have to worry about this anymore. Basically, he had way too much
time
to prepare.
Like, as far as being grandfathered in,
yeah,
he just was in Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, my man, as fucking Charles Manson.
Yeah.
And he was walking around as him, the guy who's just like, hey, Terry there. You know, like, that's him at the beginning. Yeah. Hey, is Terry here? Like, that guy, he was walking.
Stand up, a bell, you know.
Like, yeah, he was walking around like that guy for however long, and they're like, oh, it's Damon Harriman, right? I'm not wrong at that. Like, it's is the actor Damon Harriman? Is that him? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Oh no, did I get his name wrong?
I don't know. I'm looking. Look, anyway, obviously the guy was fantastic, but the point is it's all there. All those actors killed it. Obviously, they picked the perfect person for every job. But Fincher's ability to just make it all real, even though it's like all fucking yellow as fuck, it just you're there, you know, like Tench's house is so evocative. It's just as evocative as the weird place that they interview Spec or that sexual sadist guy that Anna Torv is you know, trying to pin thinking for those other murders. It's all evocative in the same way, and you're there, even though it's highly stylized.
Yeah,
and it's just such a neat magic trick. I don't know, it is the place, but it's not an impression of the place. You know, it's not a facsimile of the place, but it is the place. And I think I love that about Fincher and all his stuff.
This is also kind of like the ultimate show an idea for actors, really, because they have to go into an interview room and figure out how to win somebody over, how to get them to start talking, and so their approaches need to change. And so it's a little bit like they're auditioning, they're a different person and figuring people out. I mean, you guys are highly intuitive, and you're able to size people up very quickly and easily and do impressions so brilliantly, as anyone who knows Rob knows. And so I think this would be a show like actors would love to be on. I mean, not only just because of Fincher, but because of this idea of storytelling and figuring people out and these human connections. And so I do find that fascinating. When I saw an interview with Jonathan Groff, who was talking about, he didn't even realize he's somebody who, like me, and I had to look up if he was from the Midwest too, but he was from Pennsylvania, not Minnesota. He smiles all the time without realizing it. And I'm like, oh, he's got to be from the Midwest. But no. But anyway, and Fincher's like, you don't even know you're doing it. And so he had to like train him to stop smiling. And he said, Groff was like, so then when we were filming, sometimes we'd hear, okay, and we're rolling, Jonathan, you're smiling, and Jonathan, you're smiling, you're still smiling, Jonathan, and we're rolling. Like, yeah. And I thought that was fascinating because he said, you don't even realize, like, of course you're an actor, you're charming, and you want everyone to like you, and you're, you know, winning everyone over. You can't do that as this guy. Yeah.
Well, our mutual friend, my dear friend, Maria Lewis, first introduced me to, because I'd never seen Jonathan Groff in really anything, and her description of him, I always enjoyed. She's like, Blake, he's like the Leonardo DiCaprio of Broadway.
Yeah.
Like, he's the biggest, one of the biggest theater stars and, like, enduring, and this guy who has crushed almost every single performance he's ever done on the stage, and only very recently has started getting the accolades, much like DiCaprio is someone's, like, favorite biggest performer. And anytime there's a show that's got Jonathan Groff in it, it's a huge show. And obviously, if you're completely out of the loop on that particular cultural mechanism, you're not going to ever know. And so it took me a while to, like, get into him on this show because, again, I'm a Bill Tench. I'm a Holt
McCallany guy. From, he was my favorite. Yeah.
He is so good. Anna Torv and Aussie, great. But, like, Bill Tench is
my dude.
This show for me in such a way. Like, it's like the same way who people, they figure out, I think about, like, their second or third watch of True Detective, how important Woody Harrelson is to the series. Like, everyone, the flashy one is Rust, and everyone's like, oh, McConaughey. And you're like, Marty's.
It's Harrelson making it all work.
It's like Marty's the fucking show. I hate to tell you this, but he's the whole show. Like, he's right there. And so for me, I was locked in immediately to Holt. I was like, this is my kind of guy. And what I've been able to appreciate more and more in the series is just everything that Groff is doing, because it's not only Fincher, right? This is the craziest lineup of fucking directors. Okay. This is a Blake Howard wet dream. So you got Fincher, who directs 7 episodes, 2 episodes by Andrew Dominik, the director of Chopper, the director of Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, directs 2, including the Manson episode. 4 episodes by the legendary Carl Franklin, 2 episodes by Asif Kapadia, who's a documentarian who came in, 2 episodes by Tobias Lindholm, who, like, you look up his name, he's the writer of Another Round, like, one of my favorite movies almost ever, with Mads Mikkelsen and The Hunt. Like, seriously, like, absolutely. And director of Another Round, The Hunt, Hijacking. Just the absolute murderer's row of, like, the best filmmakers all behind the series, as well as a great writer's room of all these amazing writers. So, like, you had Joe Penhall, who, like, did the series. You had Liz Hanna was in the show. Courtney Miles was, like, one of the big people. Jennifer Haley, amazing folk who contributed to all this show. But, yeah, so, like, when it took me longer to lock into Holt, but once I did, to Holden rather. But once I did, it really unlocked the show for me, and his performance and just all the minutiae of this guy literally learning how to emote in the most crazy high pressure situations. It was almost like an actor and character, form and function. And once you get it, you're like, oh, this is a mind-bogglingly good performance and infinitely rewatchable, where everyone else is like, you know, everyone else seemed, like, right out the gate for me were just perfect. He took me longer to lock into.
I think that's because of his character. Because, you know, and he said he thought he was playing more of an everyman than he is, whereas, like, his friends started to text him, like, so, you know, do you have people in your freezer? Are you going to chop people up? Like, when is this guy going to start killing people? Because, you know, there's something really off. We need to talk about Kevin. We need to talk about Holden, basically. But I do love that. Yeah. And talking about the directors real quick, another thing I read that I thought was interesting is, beyond, like, Carl Franklin and David Fincher and stuff, Fincher wanted as many foreign filmmakers and different people to bring their different sensibilities to this most American idea and phenomenon of the serial killer, and just as an outsider's perspective, kind of like studying it like the characters are studying it. And I thought that was cool too. Rob, go for it. I kind of talked over you there before.
No, it's really cool. I mean, I had a very similar experience to Blake. When the show came out, I was beyond excited. And then I was like, the pilot, I was like, what the fuck is going on? and then Groff really grew up. I mean, not that I'm an acting expert or anything, but I was just like, this is surprising. And like, I'm very unsettled and I don't know if I'm liking it.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously he grew on me throughout the two episodes. And then when I went to rewatch it, I was like texting Blake and I was just like, he may be the quintessential Will Graham. And then it gets up for like, I rewatched Manhunter and, you know, but I was poleaxed by how fucking good he is and how the acting is superb and like a razor blade. And then, you know, he plays those interviews like a virtuoso violinist, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
watching him go, you even see like hardened, you know, middle to right leaning Bill Tench just be led to the results of this very fucking radical, like, who are you to take good pussy off the, you know, saying these things around the FBI.
Yeah.
Is just
on the public record, on the public record, trying to antagonize, like being able to, it's a great
push the buttons.
It's a great, what do they call it? It's like,
it's called code.
It's code switching, right? Like it's that. Like you like, if you can be comfortable, it's a great skill, conversational skill, just to be kind of like meet people at their level. You know, it's like why people are like, who's your sports team? And usually that's a like something you can just get in on their level. You can speak very intellectually or you can speak to a builder. You know what I mean? It's just like, just a tradie, you know, you're happy to talk nonsense or whatever. But he's so great at code switching, and his code switching is like with the most awful, deplorable pieces of crap in humanity. And so he must sort of like code switch and say these awful things to just get them excited because they're so used to being authoritatively spoken to that they close up and they clam up and they're hostile, but he makes them feel comfortable. It's a real, like, it's a real scary skill, which is why the Will Graham of it all, who's based on John Douglas in many ways, it's like why that's scary and why you're always half there is because Michael Mann's like, you know, it's not subtext in Manhunter. It's text. It's like, you want the scent back, smell yourself. Like this guy is like that. And that's like one of my favorite scenes at the crescendo of season one. He has an interaction with Ed Kemper and Ed asks him a question. I'm trying not to spoil it because it's like one of the best moments in the whole series. And he asks him a question and you see Groff's Holden like fold up inside and actually emotes. And he goes, now that was true. He gives him a little cuddle.
Yeah.
And it's just like,
so disturbing.
Oh my God, this guy, light on his feet. Light on his feet is one Ed Kemper, but it's he's doing something in this entire series. But again, the underrated gem for me, if you said like, what's the reason you keep going back to Mindhunter? It's like, I'm going to watch the Bill Tench show. You know,
oh my God, yes.
Jesus, every
he's like
word,
all
every
my
movement.
Uncles, basically. I love him. Like, I'm related to too many people in law enforcement. And so, like, immediately, I'm like, he's my guy. I know this guy. I grew up around this guy. Like, I love him. And, but also what the job does to you. And, like, one of my uncles drank himself to death. And, you know, another one, bad things too. Another, like, couple more. Yeah, like, this is not a good thing to be in. And these aren't people that were dealing with serial killers or anything on this level, but the job changes you for sure. And so, my favorite is, I know I talk about actors' eyes like way too much, like people make fun of it before it, but like Holt's eyes, especially just like the way he reacts to Holden. I watched the scene a couple times when they first are sitting and he's smoking and they're like sizing each other up and they just met. And he's kind of like figuring out who this Holden guy is, and his eyes reacting to him is just one of my favorite things. Yeah.
you can tell Fincher basically entrusts it. Like Fincher, when he's getting the show, is like, oh, I'm getting one of my guys.
Yeah, yeah.
He can do. He'll be the foundational thing.
Yeah.
That will work in this show. And I can layer all these new elements into it, but that's the one that I get.
I mean, he should have won. They both should have won every award, and like they should have created an award
more.
For like cig smoking, because
The Academy of Cig. Oh,
and the amount of cakes that, like, that's what he said. He's like, I had to be careful when I made choices of like taking too big of a puff, because then I got to do that every goddamn time. Yeah.
The way he would shake Holly's hands,
love that,
was
love
so
that.
Fucking. I like turned to my wife and be like, "You see the way he shakes that fucking hand? I mean, it's like."
I used to have bosses in past corporate jobs who loved that.
Yeah,
they get in because you're in a non-macho environment, right? If you grew up, which I did, I grew up in an area where like the most common job for a lot of folks was just like all the guys in my year, like a lot of guys just went off and got a trade, whether they're electricians, whether they're a carpenter, whatever the case may be. So you're around these guys, or we play football, rugby union. I was playing when I was a kid. And like, you're just around a lot of like burly kind of tough guys, and they all shake hands like Holt McCallany does as Bill Tench. But I love seeing it in corporate, because then you'd see people like, oh, I'm trying to shake your hand. And it was about masculinity, it was about dominance, it was about like even though I'm in this, like,
we're on the same team,
we're on this most delicate job that there's lots of HR and lots of cordiality that is forced. It's like, I'm going to shake your hand like a man. And I used to like shake their hand, and like whenever they tried to do that, like getting close, I'd just like stand my ground and I'd just stand there and shake their hand. We're not playing rugby league here together, just chill, all right? Like, we're in a corporate environment, just relax, you don't need to like posture. But I love him, because that's he's on the ground with these work a day cops, teaching, grinding, trying to teach them basic shit. And like, huge revelations in the series come from him just looking at something and being a great detective and just going, oh, look, the trees are freshly trimmed, you know, or something like that, and it just pops out. And he's just got that intuition and that insight. But he's just he's the true everyman. Like, you know, Jonathan Groff hilariously is like, oh, I was an everyman. No, bro. Bill Tench is the everyman. You're the wacko.
You're the narcissistic killer. But the thing that is like so interesting about McCallany and is that handshake is, to me, always played less about macho and more about connection and excitement about being part of the same world, and you are safe here, you know.
Yeah.
And him and Groff together are like fucking so good, and
they just look good together too. They just look great at the table together.
They balance
hearing
each other
through doors together. They just like,
I'm so glad you guys are bringing up the handshake, because one of my most vivid memories of like being in fifth grade, DARE, you know, the program, for whatever reason, I was recruited by my DARE officer to babysit. That was a little scary, but they also had me go to the graduation.
It sounds like a whole podcast.
Yeah. They had like me go to the graduation of cops. And that we're going to be the new DARE officers. And so, like, they made us go throw a shirt, you know, over our shirt that was DARE, and then go into these aisles and shake all of these police officers' hands. Half of these people had no idea how to, like, shake a kid's hand. And so by the time I'd reached, like, the second row of these, like, really, you know,
big.
And it's for both of those things. It's macho, but it's also, you're safe here and thank you for supporting us and we're all together, you know, that idea. I mean, my hand killed me for like 2 days.
You're so tiny, Jen. You're so
Yeah.
tiny. You're so tiny,
No.
and like, and like,
I'm tall, but I'm kind of scrawny.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, I wouldn't want to hurt you. If I squeeze you too hard, I would crush you. Whereas like Rosh, when I was with Rob, he mounted me like a spider monkey and we squeezed each other. It was like, but I couldn't do that with you. I mean, firstly, it's inappropriate, but second, you're just so skinny and tiny. I wouldn't want to crush you. But yeah, like that safety thing.
But Blake, you know, people who see only hear you on podcasts or see you on a Zoom, I think they are underwhelmed by the truth, which is you are a tall glass of film.
We're
fuck.
Like the same height.
And
I
you
was
just must
so
mount
excited
it.
To be like next to Blake because I am like maybe an inch or two shorter only. And so it's kind of like we were dominating at brunch. It was like, look up, look out, motherfuckers.
Look at the height. Look at the height.
Yes.
Let me bring it. I interrupted you, Blake. Go ahead.
No. Please go. Go.
Well, I just want to talk about McCallany and Tench for another minute. And just Jen, you mentioned like what the job does to him and the exhaustion and the hours and the war against your empathy. But what's so beautiful about this show is, and him and his character specifically, is that he is the one who's constantly pointing out the very basic and grounded humanity of other people to Groff and around other cops. And so when he is cruel or aggressive towards people, it is twice as shocking. Like,
oh yeah,
with the dude with the girlfriend in I think Pennsylvania or something, you know.
Yes.
And then, and at the same time, you see he's like, you know, this Americana man of that age. And then when you see him in his home, just trying his absolute best with the tools that he has.
Yeah.
And absolutely not being able to be effective due to the demands of his job and to the pressures that they're faced with their son and the nature of his work. It's so fucking heartbreaking. Like he could be just some dipshit fed asshole, misogynist, macho guy.
No,
but he's a sensitive.
Yeah.
Like,
with the babysitter.
Heartbreaking guy. Yeah.
Oh, where she saw the photo and you're just, you know how much he knows and it crushed him. And then, at the cookout with all those people, he has no idea how to talk to people. And yes,
or like his little asides to just like when Holt is judgmental of people, and he's just like essentially, you know, hey, these are people working hard, faced with things they never faced with before. Maybe cut them a little slack.
He gives the greatest lol Bergman from The Insider, the Pacino line. He's like, what is these people? He's like, well, they're ordinary people, Mike, in under extraordinary pressure. What do you expect? Grace and consistency?
Yeah.
Damn it. What a great movie.
You know?
You forget how good. I forgot how good The Insider was, and I rewatched, and I was like,
I love
Gino!
That film.
Like, yeah.
And so the fucking
Jeffrey Wigand.
No, it's like a great movie, but I think about him like that all the time. It's like, these are people working hard.
Yeah.
I do want to quickly touch on, so the first series is them establishing the behavioral science unit, broadly doing their first series of interviews, exploratory versions of actually implementing the practices which will become commonplace later on in criminal investigation. And the second series is like an augmentation of that. It gets bigger. They have more people. They're accelerating. And they're building it up to the never filmed third series of like, it is now commonplace and people are obsessed with it. And the second series is so fascinating because it is set in the Atlanta child murders basically that series. And if you go on a deep dive about that specific topic, you'll learn that much later, the Atlanta child murders were actually like, there was a, there's been some great books and there's been some great investigations and things like that you can discover about, like, there was a group, there was a cohort, there was a criminal conspiracy of sorts of, like, a bunch of people that were involved, a collective to undertake all of these killings. And so you watch this series, like, use its
part of them, anyway.
Yeah, or part of them, and apply its knowledge, but also really, like, own the implications of, like, it's not a perfect science yet. It is not It's so on the shaggy edge. So it's like, it's really interesting that, like, the first series is like, does have these sort of triumphant moments. And the second series has some of those, but it also, like, it kind of, like, sets you up for this amazing conclusion to the story, but it's also, like, in situ. It's not satisfying. It's not glorified. It's still kind of broken. It's still not there. And so I think that's also, like, what's so magnificent about the show is that it's still, like you said earlier, Rob, I think you touched on it, was just like that data and the facts that inform the narrative fiction are so important that they don't want to deviate from the crushing reality of, like, failed investigations, because that's the whole, genesis of them pushing, because so many killers were walking free and so many techniques, like the polygraph, are so flawed and all those sorts of things. So yeah, it's I like, if you were talking about Mindhunter as a series, for the longest time, Mindhunter series one was my favorite, probably more because of Cameron Britton as Ed Kemper. But now I've gone back and I find myself, I just, like, because Netflix is sometimes an absolute wasteland, I find myself going in and being like, I'll just go to, like, the third episode of season two of Mindhunter and just hit play. I don't even need to know anything. I'll orient myself quickly. And then I'm like, oh, I'm right back. This show is just fucking phenomenal. It's great. It has the lineage of the continuity of what the series arc is, but they're just, every episode has something that is extremely worthwhile.
Well, and the so well said, obviously, way better than me, the ottoman of the furniture of this podcast. But
stop it.
We're
not going to ever let you get away with that shit. You are one of Jen's favorite points.
My God.
You're one of Jen's favorite guests, and we literally have a show. Ladies and gentlemen, Too Much Movie, co-hosted by out. Rob Belushi.
Yeah.
Check it out. Some great Pacino impressions. Some
it's my goal to one day be on that show. But
you got to be on the show.
I would love to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, let's figure that out.
Well, we can figure that out. We've got, like, three movies that are in the ether right now in our group chat. We'll make one of those work, Jen.
The second season too is so interesting, because the first season is executed so flawlessly. I mean, Jesus Christ, when he walks in on his girlfriend in that, like, happening in season one, right? In the Holden.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. God. And that's, like, his, but anyway, that fucking broke my heart. And that the conversation that they have after is just like,
the conversation on her porch is an all timer.
It's an all timer for the work and for his character.
Yes.
All in one. And, like, but the second season to me, Blake, you put it so well, is it's so horrifying, because season one is all about what happened in the past and making sense of things that have already happened. And then you're dropped in to this obviously failed investigation and the absolute
helplessness
of the law enforcement machine, even though that chief, I think, is painted in, like, a really sound and, you know, caring way. But then the absolute chaos of all of the killing. The stakes are so high, and you're swirling, and they're in their hotel rooms, and, like, everything is unmoored, and people just keep dying so fast. And it's
like,
I'd watch them 4 or 5 episodes at a time, just because
you descend
into this abyss. Yeah, it is. And it's so effective and so unlike the vibe of the first season.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a great, elevated stakes, but also just, it's a fucking anvil on your neck. And ultimately, you know, where it goes. I guess I won't spoil it either, but it's crazy. That story's crazy too. That
Albert Jones, Albert Jones plays Jim Barney, who's the other Atlanta FBI agent in the show, yes, as well, who's one of my deeply
wonderful,
underrated guys.
Yes.
He's so good.
Every second of him in the show is amazing.
I'm like, and he's amazing.
Yeah, he's so great. He's perfect. He's so perfectly calibrated. That's, I think, why I keep coming back to season 2, because there's just a couple more of these interesting characters. Yeah, yeah. I really love
That one scene when he goes into that one child's room.
Yeah.
Just looking. Keep going. There's another one. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Michael Severus, I think, is his name, who plays assistant director Gunn, who's their new boss.
Yeah.
Who's their, he's just got such a sleazy edge, and I love him. I love him. He's like, you want Manson? I'll get Manson. You want Manson?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, and he's like comparing Jonathan Groff to like a horse that needs to be castrated or to wear blinders. I'm just like, this guy is fucking great.
Is he Alec Baldwin in The Departed yelling Patriot Act? That's that guy.
Yeah.
And we haven't really talked about Anna Torr, but
we got to get to Anna Torr. She's an Aussie.
Oh my
bless
God.
Her heart.
She's amazing. And
absolutely amazing.
The amount of preparation when I was doing some research, like even for the audition, the amount of reading and reading upon reading. I mean, she is just the most thoughtful actress in the way, like you can see her thinking in character, which is like, you know, a hard thing to achieve, the way she relates to people. I liked that they finally brought her in to, you know, do some interviews. Her whole arc is interesting. I feel like sometimes with the love lives, all of these characters, they were grasping at straws. Like the season 1 girlfriend got on my nerves pretty fast. And because she was kind of voicing, you know, stuff for the audience and sort of like helping us unlock his internal mechanisms, and I understood that, and that's kind of tricky. Bill Tench's wife is Nancy is amazing.
The best. She's the inverse of that.
On second watch,
yeah,
she becomes like,
yeah,
I'm like, wow, is this a special performance for me?
Yeah, yeah,
and a special woman.
Yeah,
what do you do?
I don't know what you do.
It's a it's a living nightmare. It's a
living nightmare.
It's the worst thing you could ever hope for. It's like the tragedy of not being able to like bear kids, and then getting the dream realized of being able to adopt. And then that situation happening, and the one person who can actually make sense of it so rarely would be a husband. Because the husband is actually an expert in the field, right? Usually a husband is there for, you know, the financial support and the moral support and all that sort of stuff, and the emotional support. But like, this guy is literally an expert. He's watching other people's kids. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And he cannot stop. Like that's when she's like, I need you to stop working. I need you to be home. And he can't.
Like,
and then he's faced with
dying. Mm-hmm.
It's just an impot. Like, I turn to my wife. I'm like, what do you do? And you leave, you know, like fucking the couch. I interrupted you though, Jen. I'm sorry.
No.
You were going to go on to Anna
Torr. That she, I think, they realized what they had more with her in the second season. I think, and by design, you know, she is more restrained in the first season. And kind of like they're all kind of finding their footing, exactly what Blake said and so eloquently and brilliantly about how they're kind of coming together and establishing this unit in that first season. And then it's like, okay, we have this, and now we have Congress and we have the money and we have the backing and we have Mr. Patriot Act, you know, cheering us on. But then it's like, we're still not sure exactly what to do with these tools, and we haven't, you know, can we apply the same brush with everybody? There's bureaucracy, there's questions of regional issues, you know, all the different problems, and they're still kind of figuring it out. And so I do find that her narrative, again, with the romance, it kind of gets a little much, but at least they gave her some, you know, more professional agency. It was cool to see her.
You didn't like Anatole, like hooking up with hot bartender?
With the
Lauren
bowling
Glacier
lady. Yeah.
With the bowling bartender.
That was shocking to me that she actually kissed her in the bowling alley. I was like, oh my God, she's going to walk out. Yeah.
That scene to me, like, I felt so fragile for her.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
And like, speaking of somebody, like the mask, they all three of them are, you know, Tench's like mask of gregariousness, Groff's masks of like, you know,
Groff's barely wearing a mask. He's like, the first season, he doesn't even know what a mask is. And in the second season, he's actually learning. And whereas Dr. Wendy Carr, so Anna Torv and Tench, they know what they have to do to maintain their station, if you like, in this place. Like, they know what they have to do.
She's so vulnerable. And
because she's so smart. Sorry, Rob. She's so smart. And I just want to go back, because she like writes the questions in the playbook for this.
I know.
And then what's so cool about is her personal failure at firstly trying to negotiate with people in politics and power. And secondly, her first personal failures of like trying to get people to talk. And then she realizes that, just like Holden, what she criticized Holden for, which is bringing people down to their level, talking to these people at the level that they approach her, and seeing how that interplay goes, especially in that great interview where she's alongside Greg Smith as Joe Tuttle, their like little offsider.
Yes.
When she's in there and she realizes that she has to adapt her questionnaire to fit
her
with
theory.
Exactly. Yep. And so when she meets that, that's when the character explodes for me, because she's like, oh, okay, what I've been criticizing this guy about, which I think is like being a know-it-all, or being, you know, taking things the wrong way, or like just, you know, completely, you know, going completely off book.
Everything, fit his hypothesis. Yep.
Yeah. It's actually, no, there is a deep-rooted science in it, which is that you have to meet these people, these uneducated, kind of affronting personalities at their level. You have to speak to them in their own language in order to remove the walls for them to come out and spit out the things that are actually going to be useful. So when she does that moment and she gets it in this series, it's like, it feels like it unlocks it. And just one last detail on them. I love that Dr. Wendy and Bill just fucking sit away from Holden because he's insufferable. They're just like, I don't want to sit in his fucking insufferable guy. I love him and he's great, but man alive, he's an insufferable prick. So Bill's like in his office, shuts the door, in her office, shuts the door, like they're next to each other. And they're just like, let Holden hold court out there. We can't be asked with, you know, listening to him every day when we don't have to.
Well, and his treatment of Holden is so fucking restrained until like next on the riverbank, you know, when cops to what's going on in his house, after Holden continually like fucking nags him about his availability, and justifiably so, but at the same time, it's like a beautiful moment. Even the way he does it is restrained and professional, even though it's highly animated. And then getting on other people's level. Yes, it's getting to their level, but also, which bespeaks Kemper's, like, that was true, you know?
Yeah.
Is that what she learns, and what Holden learns very quickly, is that these predators are profilers.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
They're profiling all the time. And if you go in there with some fake ass shit or some bureaucratic distance, they're not going to play. They want to get in the mud, and Holden obliges. And he gets in the mud. He uses instinct to do it in a way that they will participate with. But it's the truth of who they are, and they deal honestly. And then
the spec interview too, when he says those things, and then a spec at the end doesn't like that he's been played, and he just gets the bird and he just goes whooshka, and he throws it like this thing that he's nurtured back to life, and just whooshka, it's not their fucking night. Like, he's just, oh my God, this series.
That guy was fucking unbelievable.
But the one
Torb's moments, I love Torb's moments. I'm sorry, Jen.
No, go for it with that. Stick with that.
So you're, I love that she does more and we get to know more about her professionally, but those moments of her alone in that corporate housing, trying to feed that cat, that weird splash of color in her like pre-designed apartment.
I know.
Just the loneliness of all of them is so overbearing. You know, them in their hotel rooms, Bill Tench at home, her knowing that her sexual denunciation will obliterate her life's work. It's drama and I love it, even though it's like fucking weird sex killers.
Loneliness and like existential malaise and living in America is like Fincher's thing, basically.
Yeah.
All of those movies. But couple things you pointed out. I think this is why I probably prefer like Zodiac and this to something like, I mean, Silence of the Lambs, great film, but I don't love it. But I haven't like revisited it that much, that kind of thing. I'm not a serial killer person, but I think what's interesting is Fincher talking about it. He said, I did not want to do Silence of the Lambs because he's like, you know, that is this mastermind. And, you know, the way that serial killers had been portrayed as these like, I mean, almost like a beard stroking James Bond villain, like, I'll get you next time, Gadget. You know, that whole, like, it was a little much. And these are profoundly sad, messed up people that we can't all figure out because we can't think like them because it's a different thing. And just writing people off as insane. Are they insane? Because they're actually undertaking this idea of planning this. There's, you know, premeditation. They're figuring out every way not to get caught and how to do this, how to achieve it, and the roots of this. And he said that was far more interesting than just this idea of, you know, ooh, the, you know, fancy serial killer that's just going to talk about, like, you know, have a one-liner that's going to stick with you or be part of the culture. And I think also that's why I don't like Seven that much. I saw it once in the theater, I think once a couple years later for something professional, and then haven't really felt the urge to revisit that one either. Whereas Zodiac, I'll watch all the time. I didn't want to watch it. I actually asked this guy I was dating who was really obsessed with the case. And he's like, oh my God, you got to see this. I'm like, can you, you know, tell me, is it gory? Is it? No, it's like All the President's Men. And he talked me into it. And I'm glad he did. And because I became obsessed, it's more of a journalism.
Did we date? I can't remember. Did we date?
You know, did we? We might have, Blake. Actually, he was Irish. Yeah. But he was also secretly engaged, and I didn't know that. But anyway.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But at least he got me into Zodiac, right?
That's fair. And using the comparison of All the President's Men, it's a great comparison. But no, I get where you're coming from. It's like, I just love
that's another podcast. Series.
That's another one.
That's another podcast.
Dudes Jen dated.
Yeah. Oh God. Can't wait to be on the sidelines of that one. I'm gonna be subscribing.
The predators that you dated.
Actually,
the Jen Johann story.
Weird you say that because I think a lot of women and men have been, you know, like creepy dudes when their kids following them around, you know, but watching the show, it was like, oh wow. Like the one that really I found just bone chilling was the girl on the way home from the bus stop, because when I was, that happened to me when I was like 10, 11 coming back, there's two guys in their early 20s in a truck tried to get me into their truck on the way home.
God,
and it was a bus. Bus stop was two blocks from my house. Yeah. And you know, and so that happened. And then like this was scary. Actually, I've only told a couple people, but a rideshare service that I took first time, I take a million because I share a car and I have a bad back, so I don't drive a whole ton. I took a ride, taken a million. I've had creepy experiences, but nothing like this. I didn't realize till I got to our destination that he had turned the child locks on in the back and I couldn't get out. And I had to, you know, I thought it was like, oh, you have to unlock it. And he didn't. And I had to shout and swear at this guy. And he was like enjoying it. And I got out and I immediately reported him. And it was just the most, I think I was numb and terrified for the first 2 days. But yeah, that happened. And so
I'm
then I'm
sorry.
watching
So
Mindhunter,
sorry, Jen.
and I'm like, oh my God, these guys are predators. And like, and just the amount of shit, like my brother remembers being in the woods with his friend walking a dog and a creepy guy like coming and asking him weird questions and then running home and then them hearing that something happened in the woods with another boy with a guy. And it's just like the amount of people that we might come into contact with that are either trying things or figuring it's scary. And so that was chilling watching the show.
Yeah, I've told this story a couple of times, but it's when I was when my friend Maria was living with us, there was like one of the nights I just go, okay, I'm going for a run. It's like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. My kids go to bed. My wife is on the couch with Maria just sitting there. She's like, wait, you run at night? I'm like, yeah. And she's like, I would never fucking, I'm a
No way.
woman. I would
No.
never walk at night, run at night. I don't care
Nope.
how well lit it is. I would never do it. And I have one ear of my headphones in, and I started laughing. And she's like, "What are you laughing at?" I go, "Well, this is when I was doing Zodiac Chronicles, so I was listening to the Zodiac audiobook while I was running." So I
Oh my
was
God,
like,
Blake.
"This is what a guy does," because I'm not attuned to the danger that you see, because I'm the bozo who's like, just by sheer fact that I'm like a bigger, taller guy, like I don't feel under threat as much. You can totally feel threatened, and I have felt threatened and gnarly situations and all those sorts of things. It's a story for another time. But just that inclination that I can just go for a run, I'm okay, I'll be fine. And like go for a run for a few Ks, come home, it's fine, no problem. But that idea that there is this predatory underbelly, and that this show teases out of, like, the more people that you have, the greater the population. The just by scientific definition, you've got people who are more likely to exhibit these kind of behaviors, and they're more likely to pop up. And we need a behavioral profile to get them early, like to identify them, to have a little asterisk on that person to say we need to keep an eye on that person for all the stuff that we now recognize as, obvious. These guys are on the cutting edge of, like, even just naming serial killer, like, rather and an organizer and all those sorts of things. And what are the behavioral things that happened in their childhood to make them more to ping a few flags off to make sure that, that they don't get to a point where they start experimenting or doing those gnarly things. They can kind of get caught, because yeah, it's the reality is as scary as this movie, as scary as this series is reaching for.
It's I think one of the most chilling too is when the profile doesn't match.
Yes.
I had a professor who told me like the weirdest story. She's like, I brought my kids to the fair, and one of them was in a stroller, and we had a baby, and my husband was down at a different ride, and he was with the other kid, and this woman behind her just started talking, and like, oh, cute kids, and like they were talking back and forth, and she said, if you want to go on the ride with the older one, I will watch your kid. And she said for like 5 seconds, she thought, sure. And she even started to like undo the, and then she just had this weird feeling and said, you know what? I'm good. And when she started to get on the ride, she looked over, that woman had booked, had just completely like ran. And so you're just like, just the weird when it doesn't match. It's not like a person you would expect or something like that. And so I think when you're watching Mindhunter, it's creepy on a different level because it starts, you start realizing, oh my God, these people are all around. The masks we wear, as you guys opened this episode with, and it's eerie. And Atlanta, I mean, you wanna stop it, and it's. When you can't, and like, how do you solve a problem and you don't know how many people are involved? It's,
Yeah, when it's systemically complicit in Atlanta, it's so infuriating, because you want it to just be one lone
One easy thing.
nutbag. Because once you find them, or once you profile them and they fit, it like becomes almost obvious. You can theatrically orchestrate a plan to ensnare them with a whole bunch of techniques. But when it's systemic stupidity, bureaucracy, and potentially a criminal conspiracy involving lots of powerful people with multiple locations and people who are all complicit.
And a ton of racism.
It does all of that.
Well, I'm sorry for those experiences.
They're awful,
Jen. And yeah, I mean, I always like, I used to teach a little bit of improv, and I'd say, like, you know, it's a first date scene. Guys, you know, in a heteronormative pairing, that, you know, but like, guys, what are you, catch everything. What are you trying? What's your agenda? And it was always like, oh, you know, is she liking my joke? Is she think I'm attractive? Yeah. Is she going to let me kiss her? Is it going to go up? You know, and then, ladies, what's your agenda? Am I going to leave this date alive? Is this person safe? You know, and like,
is this stranger going to come into my house?
Yeah. What can I tell him? What can I share? And like, I feel like Anna Torv knows that very deeply, even on, you know, obviously non-heteronormative level, but that is her reality all the time. And it's, you'd like to think that it's not as acute now, but
it's more acute because you're in people's phones.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All these stupid dating apps and messages.
Oh my God. I've never downloaded one. Nope. No way.
I'm on 40 of them, but just for research.
Exactly. Rob is.
I just want to know how the kids are hooking up.
Yeah. Oh my God.
But look, besides that, you know, Jen, what you were saying about, and I think Tench does such a great job of laying into this idea against Holden, which is these guys aren't fucking interesting geniuses. They're fucked up. Trash.
Yeah. And Anna Torv's my favorite one is like, he's like, I want to talk to Manson. And she goes, well, he hasn't killed anyone, so he doesn't actually fit our brief.
Yeah.
And like, people may infamously say he's the most infamous serial killer of the 21st century or whatever. And it's like, no, he's just a guy. The 20th century, sorry. He's just a guy. He was a manipulative fucker. He didn't kill anyone.
Mm-hmm. Frankly, I see Manson. Manson is here, and fucking little shit weasel Greg is right here. In terms of cowardice and you know inability to just, I don't know. Greg I mean, he gets a couple moments in season two where you kind of like with the principal. God, the fucking principal. Remember that?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, that one is good. And then in season two, I have to say, I'm blanking on the actor's name, but the actor who plays the guy that they ultimately, I don't know if we want to spoil it, but I mean.
One of the clear targets, Christopher Livingston plays Wayne Williams.
Williams. Oh, God. This actor is phenomenal. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
That fucking guy did not win an Emmy or a gold. It's just like,
Rob,
this is why I hate these.
Everyone, you know, like the craft service people deserve a fucking Emmy.
The production design, the directors, the scripts, like that Manson script.
The teamsters who drove them. Come on.
I mean, obviously, Rob, you got to read parts of it to audition for it, but can you imagine just like the finished script of that episode that Andrew Dominik directed? Can you imagine how intricate and perfect, especially because of what that basically 5-minute Manson monologue is, and where it's situated in the season. And just Jesus Christ, it's so good. It's like, it's got such staying power.
Mm-hmm. When he grabs the book and signs it and says, "Hey man, can I have your shades?" Like, and then,
oh God,
then he says he stole
them. He stole
fucking. Oh man, yeah, the Wayne Williams thing, like, really interesting. That case and the I'm sorry, my brain is kaput.
The perp who's looking for who's made a press kit, basically, is something I love. Is because around this time we started having the celebrity killer. And I think it probably started with Manson and maybe the son of Sam, all of that, you know, was everywhere.
God, that's a great one.
And then they all started to like idolize each other. Like Tench saying, oh yeah, making, you know, signing things like, ooh, did he mention me? You know, that kind of thing. It was, it's a little like star fucking, but basically star fucking for serial killers. Yeah.
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 Like how I treat Bill Boyle. Who is in my closet tied up right now.
Is he really in France and Spain right now? Or is he
he's fucking missing.
House?
Yeah.
He's missing in action.
He's in my own private yacht for the rest of his life. But the Wayne Williams stuff is interesting, just like what's happened since he's been incarcerated. And you know, people are kind of, maybe he's not the guy, maybe he is. I don't know. But it seems unfucking doubtable that it's him.
Oh yeah. At least that he's part of it, right?
And that's the whole. Yeah, at least two of the killings. Yep.
Well, yeah, multiple killings in that run are him, or him getting people into cars and taking them to locations. He's complicit. He's complicit, and I just that there's nothing like that. You know, Fincher does. Fincher kind of has that great, whatever you think about the film, I love it. Fight Club. He does that great, like, couple of, what do you call it, like montage moments of Ed Norton traveling across the country and losing his fucking mind in the commute. And that this show has that, where it's like these guys going out all night, coming home during the day, go get diner lunch, stay outside. And when you hear the splash, the suspicious splash in this movie.
Oh, my God.
In this series, it is fucking... It is
splash.
Splash.
I think that's the thing I remembered most before the rewatch.
Yeah.
Is that splash.
That splash. And you're just like the whole, like three
Something
episodes.
Went in the water.
Yes.
Three I episodes know. Of if you're, and then a car, and you're like, and like, and they've got their
line. Yeah, yeah, too, like about them kids or something, and you're like, oh my god,
that whole, chills. Oh, that's gross. But yeah, that, you know, that's just magnificent storytelling. You know, movie, you know, TV storytelling. Great.
So why did I mean, like Mr. In Between, this would have been a perfect 3-season show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What the fuck? Like,
it costs so two things, like. Netflix.
It took them a year to shoot, right?
It costs a lot of money. It costs a lot of money for them to make the show because Fincher is completely uncompromising on that. It takes a while for them to nail the scripts, and they've got a good sized writer's room with really accomplished writers. There's no like, there's no like newbies. There's like fucking Liz Hannah does like one episode. She's an Academy Award nominated writer. Yeah. It's like it's like there's some serious pulling power in that group of people who orchestrate the show. They're all extremely experienced, all these huge directors, huge actors that come in to do the series. And it's a period piece, so it's expensive. Like, they spend a lot of time in post-production making it. But I mean, if you look at just the production value of this show, it's so immensely better than most shows that are on the platform. And so I just think it took a lot of time, and they wanted money, and they also wanted a little bit of time to develop it, because the rumor was that the third series would star Michael Mann as a character, which would have been the greatest thing ever. One Rob Belushi gets another audition to play Michael Mann on the series would have been pretty outstanding. But it was about guys like that. Demi and Michael Mann would have been characters in the show, because it would have been 90s once it's more established and stuff like that, once they exploded.
Like,
and then
Joker,
you know,
origin story that this God. Didn't happen.
Yeah. It's so awful, right? And so that... that all happened, and they just didn't have the money, and Netflix was like, look, you don't get Stranger Things views, so you can't do it. Whereas I would argue that all the time.
I watched the first season. That was it.
It's like, it's fine.
I watched the first fucking episode. I was like, nah.
I think, a couple in, and I'm like, I'm good.
Nah.
Guys, I've watched all the Stephen King stuff already. I've watched the films. They're just
the Urtext.
Yeah, I've watched the Urtext. I'm fine. Like, thank you. It's like those people who love Red Dragon more than Manhunter Rob. It's just like, what is wrong with you fucking people? Just go watch the things.
So last night I read the part in Red Dragon that talks about Dolarhyde as a young boy.
Yeah.
Saying, and unable to speak with his cleft palate, saying, trying to say grandma and like the Amma, and like, and it was like, I felt myself Will Gramming. And it's so like this fucking poor kid. But it's just such a fucking confounding idea of like, I know there's sociopaths that are born, right? Mm-hmm. As evidenced in this Zoom box here.
No.
And then there's these people that are like made, and it's that nature nurture concept in the scariest way. And
yeah,
where does your empathy, like Dr. Bloom is always like, this boy was put through hell, you know? And how do you look at the world? Do you look at it the way Tench does? And these kinds of questions are so, it really moved me last night. I was like crying for this fucking for the Tooth Fairy, you know what I mean? For the Red Dragon. And, but that's, I mean, that's why I love this stuff. It puts you in these impossible positions that you can see in smaller moments in your own life. You know, like Bill Tench's house. I've lived that way, you know, not specifically, but I'm babbling now, but yeah, Amma.
they then, in summary, Mindhunter season 3 has always been teased, but everyone's, you know, I think COVID happened as well. That was all around that same time. Cause it's like, so the series went all the way to 2019. It hits the COVID times. They don't know what they're going to do. Fincher goes off and makes The Killer. Mank, The Killer in sequence, because he was making Mank at the tail end of that. And then he was going to pick up the show again. And it was just like Netflix just didn't find it as the right investment. And, you know, the kind of criminal thing is that they're just like, it's over. And everyone in that show really wanted to keep doing it. And everyone in that show loved it. And everyone in that show was getting a great paycheck. And then, but you know, you see Holt McCallany goes off and does like an award interest
conversation
in
the
Iron Claw. Yeah, does amazing stuff there. Holt McCallany goes and wins that elusive Tony Award for the huge thing. Anna Torv's off making stuff. Like, so everyone who was the core group of that show, and all particularly the behind the scenes filmmakers, have all gone off and made huge shit. They all just like went and did stuff. So it's a really interesting how that all evolved, because they all, like everyone who was that alchemical core group of folk, all went off and made a whole bunch of other shit. And like, for me, when I see that a show can have, you know, a show can have like Tobias Lindholm, who I absolutely adore. Like, if you haven't seen Another Round, you must watch it. It's one of the best movies I've ever seen in my life. And,
and
Mads being one of the best actors that is working. To see Carl Franklin getting cash, you know, like
always,
the director
mostly in TV now, and but always great.
So yeah, see Carl Franklin with a, you know, money in his pocket, and Andrew Dominik, an Aussie director who hasn't directed enough, as far as I'm concerned, but he's just that. That's just his way. Yeah, it's really fascinating to me. So I'm always devastated that Mindhunter just didn't keep going, because it was the, you know, shared such a kinship with Zodiac, which, you know, here's a little on my microphone. Here's a little Paul Avery. He lives on my microphone. So yeah, it's just one of those things where it's telling this story on the biggest possible canvas.
So let me put you in an impossible position then.
Yeah.
If you have to pick one, and maybe this is an easy one for you, because some people aren't very, you know, aroused by True Detective season one, but yeah.
Hand raised. I don't do that show.
Yeah, I think Jordan isn't a big fan either, and you know, he hates Pizzolatto, but I love the show. Mindhunter and True Detective, I know they're very different, but like, if you have to pick one, which one is
I have to pick True Detective season 1. I just think True Detective
amazing.
season 1
amazing. I'm fucking surprised. Amazing.
True Detective season one for me is like, there may never be a single series of a television show that is as good as that. And I'm like talking, you're in the rarefied air of like Deadwood season one. Like I love Sopranos. Like Sopranos is like when you, especially there's that recent doco about what's his name? The guy who I've just lost David it. The creator Chase. Of David Sopranos, Chase. David Chase. Mm-hmm. That terrific doco about David Chase. Not stuff necessarily you haven't seen before. A great entertaining doco nonetheless. All it taught you was that they will never make another show that's like The Sopranos. Like, it's one of the most unbelievable feats of everything. The Wire, like, fucking unbelievable show. I'm obsessed with it. I watched it to death. Deadwood, one of my favorite shows of all time. True Detective season one, outside of any of the other seasons, I'm sorry to say, that is such a fucking amazing, amazing show.
I mean, Mindhunter I watch it every year. I watch it so much. Blake, you're just a regular type dude with a big ass dick. I mean, that's the thing with you, you know?
Jen, that's a line from True Detective. It's an Armani line.
Jen's like, I was what? Like, all of a sudden, like, do I need to leave you guys alone?
Yes. Always it's Robin, I need to be left alone. But no, yeah. it's my absolutely, I watch it every year too. I've watched it so many times with the greatest respect to every other series afterwards. Every time I watch even one episode of any of the concurrent series that have flowed, I just immediately turn it off and just put the other series on because I'm like, this is what I actually want to watch. But the gap between True Detective season one and Mindhunter is not yawning. It's not that far in retrospect. It's very close. It's just a different vibe. And that series, the texture of that series is just a different vibe. It's.
I feel like Mindhunter is like carbon monoxide in my house.
Yeah.
And like I'm breathing it in and then all of a sudden I'm dead. And then True Detective season one is like, I'm smoking crack and I light myself on fire. You know what I mean? And oh my God, I'm on fire. This crack feeling is going to run out real soon. I'm going to be in big trouble. Jen, True Detective season one, nothing, right?
I'm sorry. No, I'm going to be like it's that fine. Weird one who's like, you know what? Let's talk about Succession. Get Roxana Haddadi back and let's do that. But yeah, no. And also, I love me some Larry Sanders, which I consider to be drama and a comedy. Yeah. But
Larry Sanders, I mean, amazing. That's it. Jen, did you ever see The Fall?
The movie?
With Gillian Anderson?
With Gillian Anderson.
No.
It's a good show. Really good show.
Wait a sec. Is that the one with the guy from 50 Shades? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, I did see that. I forgot the title. Yeah.
It's a great one and a great like reverse Clarice Starling and her fucking line to him on the phone. I think about maybe twice a week. I mean, maybe I should more because I am the fucking portrait of privilege in this country. But when she says to him, he's like talking about his fucking ideas of women and killing. And she's just like, it's just misogyny. It's as old as time and it's boring. Mm-hmm. I was just like, fucking yeah. Jesus, this meal we make of True Detective and Mindhunter and all, it's like this that Gillian Anderson line was just like, oh, the joke's on me. As usual. I'm fucking telling a joke about someone else and mid-joke, I'm realizing that I'm actually the joke. It's the Rumblicious thing.
Yeah, so basically what you're getting is this is an intervention on our friend Rob, who we need to reassure is amazing and
stop
talking shit about himself. Yes.
I'm good.
Yeah,
he's
like Jen's Anatole, fucking so super smart, whip smart, great hair. Like just tall, just awesome. We've got Holden Ford,
prepared.
Rob Belushi here, and then you just got me, just like Bill Tench, just like a man of the people, you know.
Hey, I need to ask you guys: have you seen Lights Out? I missed it, and now I'm like, I need to see everything Holt did, TV wise. And I guess That sounded great. Him as a boxer.
No, I haven't.
Should we
seen
all watch
yet.
It and like, you know, oh, reconvene? Yeah.
I remember.
Yeah, I missed it.
He's great in it. I saw the first couple, but that was a while ago.
Let's do it.
You were talking about Shot Caller, like we were talking about Shot Caller like days ago.
Oh, that's a good show. Or a good movie.
So interesting, McCallany in Shot Caller. I love mm-hmm. that movie. And it's like if Bill Tench was pushed too far and went the other way. You know what I mean? It's interesting. He's fucking so fucking good, man.
Yeah, he's so great. Good. He's great in so many series. He's got a lot of coming up. I'm looking forward to seeing him in more stuff. He's excellent.
I just watched
like my guest here. I think you guys are.
Oh,
no. Oh, stop.
Hail to the queen.
Stop. You're too nice, Jen. You're too nice.
Stop.
This is the
keep
nicest
going.
Show.
Yes.
No.
Oh, but no, this was wonderful. And anytime you guys want to come back, let me know. Come up with an idea. You know, I'm not going to do True Detective. That's not happening.
No,
but like another
it's fine.
One.
That's reserved for Sean Cosby. I was just going to say, but Jen, you're coming up on Mindhunter soon. So you are your episode in the next little bit. Like it feels like our friends, there's this corridor of episodes, all friends of Watch with Jen and friends, our friends, you know, Jed Ayers. Yeah. Then yourself, and then there's an episode, and then it's Priscilla Page, and then it's Roxana Haddadi.
Wow.
So there's a lovely sequence of guests that are all coming up on the show. And if you just go back, Veronica Fitzpatrick, Rob Belushi and Bill Boyle, Mitch Beaupre, Carly Severn, Jess Ellicott, Michael Rothman. Yeah, it's a pretty special lineup of folks that we've got going over there. So that's where we're going to talk next for sure. They've got to get this show done for the end of the year.
Sounds good. And Rob, of course, was in Abbott Elementary the last season, the premiere. Rob, do you have anything exciting coming up?
I do. I have something really cool coming up, but I can't quite mention it yet. But
next time.
It's pretty cool.
Yes. You are working on something that is unbelievably cool. But yeah, it's one of those I could tell you, but then, you know, I'd have to kill you and it's a whole thing. Yeah. And then I'd be somebody
who's gonna
get
me.
Profiled. Yeah. Then I would be like one of these people. Yes.
Yeah. Well, no, you're too smart. I just read a book that you might like that actually you would not like it because it's okay. Similar themes. But
but I appreciate you thinking of me. Yeah.
You thought of you for a split second. You gotta think of Jen.
Yeah.
That experience you had in the car was like,
Christ,
wow,
Jen.
That's your life. Sorry, you want to fucking read a book about it. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
That's so
no,
crazy.
Idiot.
No. Oh, well, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for having
love
us.
You guys.
I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching. This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.